Viruses, bacteria, or other invisible bugs can start their journey thousands of miles away. But with the ease of air travel, they can quickly find a way into our homes, our schools, and our bodies. They settle into our noses, our lungs, and from there they can take over. Today we are diving into how these microscopic invaders migrate across the globe, and more importantly, what we can do to stop them. And that's the life's work of our guest today. For decades, Dr. Marty Citron led the CDC's Office of Migration and Quarantine. If a disease crossed borders in the last 25 years or so, from Asia, Africa, South America, or Europe, for example, chances are that Dr. Citron was helping shape the response. He is here with us today to walk us through how outbreaks move, why they move, and what it takes to stay one step ahead. It's great to see you today, Marty. How are you doing?
I'm doing great, Howard. Thank you so much for having me on your show.
Great. Thank you. So I have a quick question to start with. You're now living up in New Hampshire, but you spent years in Georgia. So which is better, or which is worse, I should say, the snow in the winter in New England or the humidity in the summer in the South?
Well, there's no comparison for me as a long-time lover of New England, born close by and most of my adult life prior to medicine was spent up here. I love the snow, and I'm not real great with the heat and humidity. So this has been a welcome change of returning home, if you will.
That is excellent. Yes, I find the humidity down in Atlanta pretty grueling. A quick question, maybe we could start with the following. How long have we been living with pandemics in history?
Oh, well, it depends on what yardstick you want to use. Pandemics have been recorded for most of human history. If you go back to Leviticus in the Bible, there's discussions of how to protect yourself from contracting leprosy, the spread of leprosy. And so ancient documents recorded the use of tools like isolation and quarantine, so to speak, not in some of those words, in order to protect yourself from the spread of contagious diseases. Of course, the modern concept of the great pandemics or plagues of human history that become well documented, you know, go back early into the 13th and 14th century, and actually even periods BC. But the classic concept of the Black Death, the Great Plague, pneumonic, bubonic plague, you know, that ravaged through Europe and the rest of the world are well known in terms of historical documentation. And in fact, the 14th century Venetian strategy of using isolation and quarantine came from the Latin to the Italian quarantina, meaning 40 days, which was to keep the ships out of the ports for 40 days until the disease burned itself out. Then they would let the ships in, they would decontaminate them and the people and set up these quarantine periods. So the modern, I would say the sort of, maybe not modern, but the neo-modern, post-modern concept of what we're using today for things like COVID really dates back, you know, hundreds of years at the least, maybe thousands.
Amazing. All words always have some origin. So there we have that word. But today something feels a little different, this pace, this frequency. Is it just me, or are we living crisis to crisis in public health right now?
We are. And I think the thing that's different, that as you alluded to in the opening, is that if you look since the between 1850 and 2000, the amount of time it took to circumnavigate the globe moved from about almost a year, 350 days, down to a matter of hours. It takes less than 36 hours to move from one place to any other place on the planet right now. And this that's been an exponential change. The speed of travel has been an exponential change. Welcome to the jet era and jet airplanes, which really are relatively new in our history, maybe 50 years or so back to the 1970s. But the speed of travel afforded by jet planes has really connected. There's no place in the world now that we're disconnected from. And if you think about my concept of how fast things are moving and the use when we were moving by ship, if it took a year to travel around the globe, or even 40 days for a disease to burn out, most of the disease that boarded the ship would express itself during the journey. And you could add to that protection by adding the 40 days, and you could sort of have a strategy for protection. But when people are moving around at such speed, less than the incubation period for most diseases, people can get on their transport on a plane and move before the disease, before they even know they have it, and before it certainly it manifests. And so the old strategy of waiting 40 days before you let the ship in is not going to deal with, it's not going to work in the modern era. The other exponential change that occurred in the same time frame is the explosion of the human population on the planet. So in that same 150 years, we went from, you know, far less than a billion population on the globe to where we're at now, at about 8 billion. And this generational change in both the speed and the volume of travel has been a fundamental, you know, tipping point for how we have to think about and deal with disease spread and pandemics in a contemporary era. There's a slide, Anna, if you will, that you can put up that illustrates this concept of how mobile the human population is today. And here's a picture that Howard, you and I have talked about a number of times. This is four generations in the same family, four male generations in the same family. In the upper left corner, you can see from the homestead, the distance in 10 kilometers increments that are shown there, the distance that an average great-grandfather would have moved from their homestead. Now, the grandfather in the upper right corner will show that distance, and the scale now you need to look at, the equivalent scale, is 100 kilometers. And you could see that the range in which people, the grandfather moved compared to the great-grandfather is a bit further, but it would still be defined as regional. Now look in the lower left corner. That's the father of this. That's the third generation. And now the scale of mobility of the tracks that individual follows measures in thousands of kilometers. But here we have the fourth generation, and I would say fourth and so on, the son of that four generations. And now you're talking about moving the scale in tens of thousands of kilometers, really a full global reach. And that's happened only over four generations of time. So that's another way to depict the geographic scope of mobility and the volume of people that you multiply that by the number of people that can move through jet travel. And you can see the problem we're facing.
So in a lot of ways, that great-grandfather is really maybe from 100, 150 years ago. And we're talking about 1,000 years before, you know, and so maybe, you know, there has always been a lot of bugs that are out there, but this whole concept of a permademic where there's always some public health crisis is just a result of what you're showing here on the slides, that these individuals are being, generation after generation, is moving a lot more. Would that be correct, or am I?
No, I think that's right. I think that in many ways, there's a lot of drivers for the emergence and the change in our behavior. Speed and volume of global travel is one of them. But there are many others as well. And I assume we'll talk about some of them as we go along. But the evolution, the speed of evolution of the microbes has also progressed. And the encroachment of humans in animal habitat, for example, has also been a part of that. So the microbes are evolving. And of course, their generations in bacteria, that's 20 minutes to a generational change. Viruses can be sometimes even faster. And they're all growing at exponential speed. So we're in some ways, you can look at it as a race. The other thing is our cultural changes and habits, the globalization of our food supply, the globalization of our animal engagement, the movement of living animate and inanimate things that are moving around the globe, that interconnectedness of our lives, the encroachment in animal habitat. So we have a much greater risk for the species spillover. And we've recently learned that spillover isn't unidirectional. Most two-thirds of the emerging infections spill over from animals, but a huge number of those will also spill back from humans back into other animal reservoirs. And so those are parts of the drivers. The use of interventions like any antibiotics, antivirals, sometimes promotes resistance because the microbe is able to reproduce very quickly and outsmart some of the tools that we're using to combat it. So if you look at this, I like to call it the sort of holy trinity of emerging infectious disease. Really, what we're talking about is this very intricate dance and interplay between the microbes, their human hosts, and the milieu or the social context. That context is an animal environment, the climate that may be changing, or the social political climate. And if there's, for example, lots of crisis and tension in the world, or economic collapse, or climate change driving population migrations, all of these things will create what I call a syndemic that is in the favor of amplifying these types of threats. And that's been going on especially recently, especially in the late 20th and now into the 21st century. That's really the kind of change we're seeing.
So talk a little bit more about these syndemics that were basically like multiple, right,
epidemics. Yeah. So let me just take one step back and say something's endemic if that event, that microbe, that contagion is sort of permanently with the population, but it's moving at some baseline rate. Some experiences that are keep it pretty stable. It's in a balance in an endemic state. If it's epidemic, it's occurring with a frequency that's and a prevalence that's beyond the normal expected, and it creates that spike or peak. But then, as you mentioned, I coined a term called permademics, because during COVID, everyone asked me, when is COVID going to go from being an epidemic and a pandemic just to be endemic, and we're just going to live with it in some easy baseline? And will it even go away? Will it disappear entirely, or will it change the way it affects us in lethality? And there are a number of pathogens which we've now seen, particularly viruses that emerge in a setting where there's an animal reservoir. So unlike smallpox, which could be fully eradicated through the tremendous feat of public health energy and global commitment, political will and commitment and use of a vaccine, these types of viruses have animal reservoirs. And many of those reservoirs, the affected animal will not get sick, but will be a permanent source of the virus, essentially a well of the virus in an animal that can always spring forth. And what we see in that setting is no matter how much we wish and how hard we try, we may not ever eradicate that virus. We can witness a number of things which move from spillover from an animal into a human, causing severe diseases, epidemics, and if those are global, pandemics. But then they may, as we get control of them, as we use our tools, as we build up immunity, as we get used to that pathogen, it may recede into the background and become a permademic. It's always there. It's always going to be in the reservoir. And if it's mutating in an animal reservoir, it has a chance to emerge in a new form that humans have never seen and that we have no immunity to. And that is actually the trigger for turning the permademic into epidemics, and if they spread globally, pandemics.
So is polio one of those, or COVID
polio,
one of those?
Polio has reservoirs that we've seen. We can do a lot to eliminate. We use the term eliminate versus eradicate when we talk about polio elimination, because there are ways that polio can persist and variations of the virus can persist, even variations of the vaccine form of the virus in wastewater and come out. But if you can permanently eliminate it from humans, you can have a dramatic effect, not only on people's lives, but on cost savings. And so the challenge of using getting every last case of polio eliminated from the planet, is before us right now. And we're close.
I know we're getting there. We have a couple of countries left, and then we'll probably be able to control it.
But the difference is that we probably will always have to have in our toolkit the ability to go back and deal with small outbreaks in isolated locations. So once we have to find them, and secondly, we're going to have to be able to bring our vaccination tools in to protect a population. Because once we stop using polio vaccines, if we've achieved elimination and we go that route, and clearly that happened with smallpox, where we literally stopped using the smallpox vaccine once it was eradicated from the planet. In the case of polio, we might have to keep that tool in our toolkit in case there are little outbreaks before they become huge events. similar to what we're talking about with measles.
Yeah, well, that brings up a really important point, because you were at CDC for years. And so I'm curious as to your perspective a little bit on all that's happening at the CDC and the concerns with WHO, because what you're basically saying is that we need to sort of always be vigilant to prevent some of these diseases from bubbling back up. And that requires public health experts and others. So just on the line of what you've been talking about, what do you think could happen?
Well, I was at CDC for more than 30 years, and I saw dramatic progress. And the progress in battling these types of threats is on multiple fronts. I mean, one is we have to be able to detect them faster. So what I saw over those 30 years in comparison to my clinical years treating HIV patients, for example, is the time from us detecting HIV until our ability to come up with the tools that we needed to slow the spread or to turn it from an acute lethal disease into a chronic condition that people can live a full lifetime with. The time from emergence to identification was slow. And the time from identification to countermeasures was slow. We were measuring these in decades, in contrast to some of the progress that we've made in being able to really detect earlier. But we still can't detect fast enough. If you think about both the speed of which things are moving and the way in which the microbes are evolving, our detection systems have to be intact, growing, robustly changing in character, and they have to be in real time. We can't even wait months or a year, like with COVID, 6 months. You know, we have to be able to detect them as soon as they emerge, and we have to be able to mitigate them very quickly at their source. And this has required an evolution in detection. We also have to accelerate our response time, and we have to accelerate our toolkit for prevention. These are much bigger problems. And what I have seen over 30 years that reluctantly I'm not seeing in the post-COVID era, in the COVID and post-COVID era, is each time we faced a new threat, and believe me, they've become more frequent, larger in geographic scope, and more impactful. They've gone from being just health threats to being whole of society threats. And what we've seen is that each time we have one, if we build on what we learned from the last time, we get systems that are bigger, faster, better, and we get closer to our goal of keeping up with this exponential growth pace. But unfortunately, because of the way COVID evolved and because of the way many of the countries rebelled against and used more of these individualistic strategies, and because of the erosion of public trust and many other things, what I fear is that we're eroding our infrastructure, and it's very critical. And I feel like we are less prepared now after COVID than we were before. And reducing our investments in cutting edge science and surveillance and infrastructure and international collaboration is at our great peril, sad to say.
So basically what you're saying, there's two parts to this, is the detection based on people and having people out there to identify things. And then there's the technology, even though they both work together. And then there's the technology that we can use to try to detect things. So the people part, like without USAID out there and without CDC in some of the countries, that becomes an issue. But then there's also the technology and some of the technology you've been working on, like wastewater detection. Maybe you could talk about both of those and sort of how they work together.
Let me tell you about the way surveillance technology evolved. I got to CDC in 1992, right at the time that then called the Institute of Medicine, now the National Academy of Science, Engineering, and Medicine. A report on emerging infectious disease came out, led by the Nobel laureate and brilliant visionary Joshua Lederberg. And I had the good fortune of arriving at CDC at the release of that report and being tasked by the director and the director of infectious disease, Jim Hughes, to work on CDC's response to that. And the idea that we saw is, one, because so much of global migration, travel, and trade, which was part of my bailiwick, was driving these emerging infections. But the other, in recognizing that we needed surveillance systems that were bigger than just the resource base of public health, we started to see partnerships emerge. And a couple of things that I personally was involved in designing: surveillance systems that connected public health and clinicians. One of the first big surveillance systems that we wrote about in the response and then ultimately received funding to build was called GeoSentinel. And it was a global network of international providers who saw mobile populations around the world and travelers, immigrants, refugees, missionaries, expatriates, the whole group who were moving. And these clinics specialized in taking care of them. So when they came in sick, we got the itinerary, we got the story, and we were able to use that to weave together. And for the first SARS outbreak in 2003 was a good example. We had clinicians in the network in Toronto and in Montreal, and they were able to tell us the disease had moved. So that was clinical-based surveillance. We also had other networks that were syndromically-based surveillance. You wouldn't always know what the or what was going on, but you knew there was a respiratory virus that had bad characteristics, was killing people, or was affecting healthcare workers. It was moving person to person. And so we had a system on the U.S.-Mexico border called BIDS, the Border Infectious Disease Surveillance System, for a wide variety of syndromes. And we had clinics and networks on both sides of collaboration. And we had syndromic surveillance. And then we moved into, well, can we back it up before people get sick? Can we do laboratory surveillance? So we had electronic networks that wove together laboratory results, particularly looking for resistance to treatment. Antimicrobial resistance is becoming a big problem globally and emerging. But we had ways for laboratories to share anonymously information about the emergence of penicillin-resistant gonorrhea or other things. So we moved from clinician-based surveillance and partnerships with public health to syndromic surveillance. We had participatory surveillance with Google. That people basically put in their story. They got online. They used, in fact, the way HIV was first discovered was a run on pharmacies for certain treatments. And so we were moving in that direction, but it still wasn't fast enough. We still needed to be moving earlier. What we saw is the ability in particularly in COVID, but not always. We took a lesson from the polio playbook and realized that wastewater often was harboring the pathogens that people were excreting, and they would be excreting them whether they were symptomatic or not. And so we started looking at, particularly during COVID, early 2021, we started setting up a national wastewater surveillance system around the United States. And we found that you could detect not only GI pathogens, like in the case of polio, where it's coming through the GI tract, but even respiratory pathogens, even Legionella was being detected through urine. So all of that stuff that ended in the wastewater. And you could probe the wastewater. If you knew what you were looking for, you could set up PCR, polymerase chain reaction, and go after the genome before you were going after the laboratory host response detection and before you were waiting for people to be sick and showing up dead in clinics. And that moved the clock back a little bit and sped up our ability to detect. And now the next step is to take those into special settings where people move. So we had set up a traveler genomic surveillance system at hub airports that represented the ability to see people moving around the globe and test them voluntarily when they landed and see whether they were carrying SARS-CoV-2 in their nose. But the real breakthrough was proving that we could detect this from the wastewater of a plane. And in under a minute, you could collect the wastewater or the blue water coming off an airplane when it touched down. And then you put it in a system, when did PCR, and then you could do whole genome sequencing and you could characterize not only was it there or not by PCR, but what was the genomic makeup? Was there a variant that was coming in and being introduced?
So using that bathroom on the airplane is not the worst thing in the world.
Yeah. And you sample essentially without interfering with an individual, without getting into privacy issues. You're sampling 200-300 people at a time. So this concept of pooled sampling and knowing what's there and doing it fast. The future, we have to get even faster because TGS was able to get answers, a whole profile, in about 8 days. But there are tools out there that we've been working with incorporating into the future where you can get that same answer in 8 hours.
So this is a great way of detecting things. That's using technology. You mentioned before a little bit about what people are doing. I mean, air pollution, a lot of mobility, obviously. But what else are we doing in the environment that's affecting and causing the increase in spread of diseases? And then how do we change that?
So think about, let's take a couple of examples. Let's take an example of a natural disaster like the earthquake in Haiti in 2010. Okay. It's a poor country in our hemisphere, among the poorest, really limited infrastructure, crowding and all sorts of things in the urban areas, and then sort of a difficult set of resources, both to detect and well as to respond, treat, and prevent. During that earthquake, there was a massive amount of disruption, and increase in disruption often comes with the tensions and violence and instability, people that are under a lot of duress. And so the international response involved bringing in a lot of peacekeepers, if you will, folks that were that around, and they were imported from all over the globe to make up a United Nations peacekeeping force in the setting. So here you have a climate environment, a natural event, an earthquake in a very vulnerable population that creates instability, unrest. There was a massive outbreak of many things that were at risk of that. But once the peacekeepers were arriving to bring a little bit of order to the chaos and to the tension and the strife, it turned out that the peacekeepers introduced cholera into the Western Hemisphere and into this crisis-prone environment, and a cholera epidemic exploded. Now, this was a bystander effect, and certainly an unintended negative consequence, but it gives you this idea of syndemics and how the microbes, the hosts, and the environment or the cultural context interact to amplify an accelerated event. There are many other examples like this that I can share. Yeah,
I was down there after that earthquake to provide anesthesia and to help out. And I remember looking around and saying, this is how infectious diseases spread.
Absolutely.
I mean, it was unbelievable. The environment was sort of a mess, and disease was spreading, and just the whole situation was really very concerning.
And that's true of these types of situations. So in this case, it was an earthquake. In other cases, it could be climate change increasing the temperature and making parts of the globe that were not hospitable to insect vectors that spread disease suddenly be a receptive environment for Aedes mosquitoes. And in that case, you risk the spread of dengue, globally and accelerating. So this is what is meant by the term of syndemic, in which some type of crisis event, maybe it's a non-health event, a weather event, a political event, a war, an outbreak, displacement, refugee populations, economic collapse, all those things, they drive migration, they drive crowding, they cause destruction of resources, they disrupt vaccination program, which keep those diseases in check, like measles and tuberculosis. And then the epidemics creep in, they find this niche, they exploit it, the microbes exploit the vulnerability, and the infrastructure has collapsed to the point where the ability to detect, respond, and control and prevent is lost. And that's how this cycle of syndemic happens.
And what can we do, the public do? I mean, if the average person said, how do I help protect the environment and protect others from getting spreading these diseases, should they obviously be vaccinated, but are there other things that they should be doing?
I think there's a lot of things that will increase our resilience, and some of that is being a good maintaining a strong sense of health literacy. You've got to really be in the know, and you've got to be in the know and getting your information from reliable sources. And again, back to what you said about using the institutions that are trusted institutions that are out there to try to give us reliable information that's fast and accurate and actionable. And we rely on these institutions and have for my entire career in public health to be as fast as possible, as accurate as possible, as nimble as possible, because these are dynamic settings which change by the hour sometimes. And you have to be able to update them. We need to, as individuals in society, responsible individuals, we need to realize a couple of things. We have to maintain a level of health literacy and a trust in the sources that we use in order to have an accurate idea of what's going on. The second thing is, these are kinds of problems that are not necessarily things that individuals can control all by themselves. We could take care of ourselves, we could look after ourselves, we could protect ourselves. Those are very wise things to do. But we are much stronger together. And collectively, we need to be part of the system that goes beyond the me, that includes the we. We have to be accountable to ourselves and our neighbors. And we have to be involved in the solution collectively, because there is really in this world, those that survive and are resilient are those that remain intra-connected and collaborative rather than in tension with one another, but really supportive of one another.
You bring up, you and I have spoken about this, about how sometimes you could turn to nature for an answer. So maybe you could share a little bit, because you hooked me on this book about trees, and I've always thought about like trees that are alone, how they fall in a storm, or trees that are together don't fall so quickly. So maybe you could share that, because you were the one who brought that book to my attention.
Yeah, I want to show your audience the book. This is called The Hidden Life of Trees, and it's a delightful book by Peter Wallaben, and it's discovering the secrets discoveries from a secret world. So if you think about trees, you know, they're the most resilient and longest living species on the planet. Their lifespan is measured in the hundreds, if not thousands of years. And in fact, a tree doesn't reach adolescence until it's 100 years old. So they've slowed down time, and they've survived on the planet despite unbelievable obstacles and hardships. And the way they do it is, you, when you're looking at a tree in a forest, you're only seeing part of what's really there. You're seeing the upright, you know, trunk and the branches above. But really, and that may be the agency or the individualism of a tree, but really below the soil is where all the action is. And below the soil, the tree's roots are intra-connected and share a common DNA. And their strength is exactly in that network. I was just re-looking at this book this morning to share some thoughts with you. And I came across this line: there are more life forms in a handful of forest soil than there are people on the planet. A mere teaspoonful contains miles of fungal filaments, and all the work the soil to transform it, make it valuable, and build the defenses of the tree. This whole mycelium network that is intra-connected with the roots network is responsible for the fortification for those individual trees to stand upright. And so, you know, back up here, I'm in the shadows of Dartmouth, and in the recent celebration of, I think it was 100 years since Dr. Seuss graduated from Dartmouth. And one of my favorite books growing up was The Lorax. The Lorax, who speaks to the trees. So if anything, I'm here to tell you that Dr. Cetron, in addition to Dr. Seuss, is trying to speak for the trees. And I think that they're telling us that we as humans, if we want to be strong and resilient, we have to, it's not that we can lose our individualism or our agency. The agency is important. It stands upright, but it does that on the anchor of a connected root system, an interconnected root system, and a relationship and partnership with fungal mycelium and many other things in order to be that. And I think that's what we're going to need to do, the human side. So as you said, there's the technological side of dealing with scale and speed, going to whole genome sequencing, finding things faster and earlier, responding more quickly, being robust, designing, you know, better, faster vaccines, the miracle of the COVID vaccination strategy, and within a year of discovery, really rolling out that kind of protective, you know, life-saving influence. But we also have to be very conscious of the social context in the milieu. And so, as a friend of mine, Daniel Siegel, says, he's a psychiatrist, said, really, it's about as simple as A plus B equals C. The agency plus the belonging to this community, the interconnectedness, is what makes a resilient, strong community. And the people part of that, what we can do individually, is to heed the lesson of the trees in this regard.
Shared responsibility, everyone working together. We're going to get to our questions in a second, but what are three takeaways from today? What do you think are some of the things we should be remembering and then telling our colleagues and friends?
Yeah, that's great. So the first one is just the awareness of how fast our world is moving in the 21st century, the era of globalization, this intersection of speed and volume of travel, as well as the movement of the climate and many other things. We are living in a rapidly evolving world where microbes and humans and animals and our social networks are more and more complex and moving at higher speed. They are interdependent, and we have to recognize that things are moving quickly. What I've seen is the interval between frequency of pandemics over the 30 years I was at CDC just shortened. The impact and magnitude was accelerated, and the intensity and the geographic scope of them was wider. So that's part of this pace of change. We have to, that's the first one. Secondly, we are capable of using technological advantages to our strength, and they can help us cope with the speed and scale of change. New diagnostics, whole genome sequencing, wastewater sampling. We can get, over the 30 years I've been there, I've seen really, really significant progress in that. But we're not finished, and we're still not up to the task. But lastly, and as you alluded to, most importantly, the technology alone is not going to save us if we're living in a divided world with radical individualism that competes with our collective good. And I think that if there's a bankruptcy of trust and information sources in which falsehoods and bad information can circulate the globe 10 times before the truth can ever get its pants on, we have a challenge of being able to be like the trees and recognize that we are stronger together, and we have to have trusted information sources. Truth is hard to get at, and our patience and respect for one another has to exceed our need to fight and, you know, point blame. I think those are the three important things. The world is moving faster than it ever has and changing faster. Technology can work in our favor, but none of those things are going to happen without reestablishing trust in our institutions.
Mari, those are great points that are critically important, and they sort of capture what we've been speaking about for the last 40 minutes or so. We've reached the point in our show when we turn to our most important guests, which are our subscribers. And so I want to tee that up. Adora's out there teeing that up. I always mention that at this point that all of what we discuss on the podcast is for informational purposes. If there are any medical questions that come up, do talk to your doctor. They know your medical history. But Adora, let's see, who do we have on the queue for?
We have Joe Allen that's about to come up and ask his question. Joe, don't forget to unmute. Thank you.
Yeah, of course. Hi, thanks for the conversation, Dr. Citron and Dr. Z. It's been really enlightening. One of my questions was, in your opinion, what did we learn from the COVID pandemic that should fundamentally reshape how we prepare for future pandemics? Do you think that we overreacted? Do you think that we underreacted, especially as we were still learning things over those first couple weeks, months? Would we do it the same way if it were to happen again? And should it happen again, when do you think that might happen? I mean, obviously, we never really know, but these things might carry some sort of cadence. So do you anticipate we might experience some other pandemic in the next 20, 40, 50 years?
Great question, Joe. Great question.
Yeah. No, so let me try to tease them apart into separate. That was a loaded and insightful question. Let's talk about the last point you made first. And you mentioned the term patterns. So what I've seen, if you look at patterns from just the 1918 influenza pandemic through the 2020 COVID pandemic, is that the interval between pandemics is shortening. They're occurring faster. So I don't think we're going to wait 40 or 50 years, and I don't think we're going to wait 100 years for the scale of the pandemic. They also are happening with greater intensity, in addition to greater frequency and broader geographic scope, and they have become more than health events. So what was said, the one in a century health event that affected all of society in the influenza pandemic was 100 years before another one, I don't think we'll be waiting that long. That said, again, I don't think we have enough insight into all the factors, but the stuff, the makings of the next emerging threat or emerging outbreak or re-emerging things that we've really tried to conquer and done well with and kept under wraps, that needs constant vigilance, and it needs progressive advances in our ability to detect, respond, and prevent. So it's clear that it's not going to be as long and so on. When you get to, I can't tell you when it's going to happen, like date in time, but I can tell you that if we're not really if we're not always moving forward, we are losing massive amounts of ground. That can be sure. You can be sure of that. That if we put our head in the sand and stop funding our infrastructures and putting our resources into this and getting aligned collectively in a global response to what our existential threats, we're going to lose the battle. The second thing is what you said, what lessons have we learned and what would we do differently? Boy, I sure hope that every one of these crises is an opportunity for learning and changing and doing things differently. We've learned a lot. We learned things that we did well, and we learned things that we really botched, right? The things that we did well in some ways were recognizing the new tools for surveillance like wastewater. Wastewater at scale was really introduced in response to COVID. We could track the movement of variants in that time. We also learned that things that we didn't, we learned that things continue to surprise us. Despite being in this business for so long, there are things about COVID too that really surprise us. And it leaves us with the idea of having to convey and communicate uncertainty and have humility and not to simply have too much assuredness and arrogance to think that when SARS-CoV emerged and we knew what SARS-CoV-1 looked like, that is the original SARS out of China, that this would be the same pathogen and that this would be controlled in the same way and would go away in 3 months with 8,000 cases and 800 deaths. It was nothing like it. And I think too often, once we begin to label and put it in a box, we look with recency bias and we assume we got this and we didn't. And there were things that surprised some people and it shouldn't have been surprises, like asymptomatic spread. It's anywhere from 40 to 50% of all SARS-CoV-2 infections were asymptomatic. That is a powerful weapon of the virus because people who have it don't even know it and they're spreading it when they're not sick. And we had all these tools set up, including ones that I was responsible for, fever checks and history checks and exposure checks at airports arriving into the U.S. in the first months of SARS, of COVID. And they were leaky because we didn't realize all the people coming in that were asymptomatic, that were seeds. We didn't develop our diagnostics fast enough and in partnership with a broad enough group. And so we lost time in that and we lost credibility. We communicated information based on old sort of textbooks in science that this was going to be droplet and not airborne. And some of the hopeful and the wishful thinking gets in the way and creates a level of denialism, not looking at the outliers carefully enough to realize when we should have been recognizing airborne transmission sooner than it actually happened. We politicized the pandemic. It was a disaster, right? Where else in history would the use of a hygiene instrument like a mask become a political symbol and a tool for dividing us rather than unifying us? And that's kind of crazy. It was like trying to say, you know, whether you wear or don't wear underwear is a statement of what your political, you know, affiliation would be and what makes sense or whether you wash your hands or not. I mean, it's foolish. And we let that come into the complexity. And I think the other mistakes is that we underappreciated the power of the internet to amplify information that wasn't true in such a rapid pace. And then some people would say the mistakes around mandates actually were drivers into the rugged, it didn't work well with the rugged individualism of American sort of culture in many places where people being told what to do wasn't the best way to get high levels of compliance. So I think there's lots that we've learned. And the question is, what will we do with it? Will we go down the same path and repeat the mistakes or worse, bury our heads in the sand and not move forward and sort of take a punitive attitude and disable our infrastructure for preparedness and protection? Or are we going to truly look at those lessons and say, let's wake up because the next one's coming and we got to do better?
You know, that is a great response. And Joe, that was a great question. You know, one of the things I remember at the beginning of the pandemic was how everyone was calling SARS-2. And I think, I just want to echo what you're saying. Once they said, even in the news, it's SARS-2, your brain goes to like, well, this is what happened the last time. And there was this a lot of noise, but then it went away. And I think that that's something which we have to prevent in the future. But from your voice to the ears of those in Washington, that's what we need. We need you to sit there in Congress and say, here's what's going on. We need to make sure we keep the funding going. We need to make sure that we don't allow the experts who are out there doing a lot of this work to disappear, because you can't get those people back so easily once they leave agencies like CDC or NIH or even the WHO or elsewhere. But Marty, thank you very much for taking us on this journey that a virus, a bacteria, or other infectious bug travels on its way to us, which is really what we think about. And also, thank you on behalf of all the Americans for your decades of work in protecting us from these dangerous infections and the work you're doing now, the work you've done over many, many years. Now, I was thinking about this. I believe that wisdom is just knowledge under pressure over a course of time. And you have incredible wisdom. You have the knowledge of the diseases. You have been under the pressure of managing them over decades. So kudos to you for all that you have done. And I want to thank you for your friendship, your expertise, and just what you're doing now to keep moving this forward and many of the challenges that we face in the country in public health and in the world, for that matter, in public health. That's it for our show today. Next time on Docology, we will hear from the nation's expert on what makes cells work and why they tick, basically the fuse boxes of the cells inside our cells. And when they short circuit, what happens, like diseases like Parkinson's and dementia and cancer and other things and other conditions can occur. But remember, if you are a Docology subscriber, you can join the show. You just have to click on the link in the bio. And tune in next time, because the topic we cover may just save your life. Docology is a production of Hang Media. Our producer is Catherine Warren. Ronnie Selig is editorial advisor. Our creative director is Anna Richard. Janine Wilson of Wilson Media Group handles paid marketing. Our publicists are Leslie Ann Wade and Jerry Caracoli. Theme music was composed by Nick Kitts. Subscribe and join our community at docology.life. Until next time. Move, wash your hands, and stay healthy.